Mr. Forbes, Reel 6. Now, when you got to Gosport, what was the situation there?
The situation wasn't all that pleasant because I should think that there'd been a lot of people, army people, had stopped on before going on board ship in the rural domestic side of Gosport. And we were parked in a sort of side street with a lot of gardens and bungalows and things. And I think the people were a wee bit fed up with tanks and things being parked outside their door and men sleeping in their garden, because that was the only place you could sleep. Unless, of course, you were hardy enough to sleep on the pavement, but we actually slept in the front garden. And you got the feeling that the occupants weren't all that happy. But, they allowed us to do that anyway. That's good enough, suppose. The actual embarking on the ship was quite exciting, really, because you had to reverse into the jaws of the LST. And it was quite tricky because there would only be a couple of inches between each vehicle on board, and you had to go in very carefully. But usually the officer or in charge of directing you was very good at signalling, you know, the way they signalled with their hands when you were moving in. It was very good, easily done. No, I don't think there was any accidents or prangs with the tanks on board.
What was the crossing like?
The crossing wasn't... Well, it was all right. It was an American ship, and we had American food. It's sort of air rations, I think they called them. You know, harsh. And slept in... We had bunks which we slept in, but there was a prevailing smell of diesel all through the ship. I was quite interesting. The tannoy provided a little entertainment because the Americans have their own language on in the Navy, the American Navy. And it was quite interesting listening to them, you know, the Navy slang. I can't remember going up on the deck. I think we would have all liked to have gone up on deck and seen the scene of the army, because it was a marvellous sight. I mean, the sea was absolutely crowded with ships of all different sizes, and we would have loved to have seen the Mulberry Harbour. But as far as I was concerned, I never saw it, because when we reached a certain area, we were told to get down to the tank deck and climb aboard and get waterproof down, you see. So you really missed the actual approach to Europe as far as that went. We didn't get a chance to see the marvellous invasion.
Now, you were crossing on round about the 15th, 16th of June. Right. You landed on the 17th, I think it says. What was the scene on the beach when you actually... did you land in water?
Yeah, the funny thing about it is all that waterproofing, and you had a waterproof device on the gun manifold, you know, to stop water from getting into it, and it was all waterproofed up, and it had a coil of explosives in there, and the driver had a plug, you know, something like the cigarette thing on a car, and a plug, and when you plug that in, it exploded. And we never got to do that, because we landed in about 2 feet of water. And all that, we complained bitterly about all that work we put in for weeks, waterproofing them. And we could have gone in with nothing.
And what was happening on the beach?
Well, the beach wasn't all that busy by that time. It was just, we saw one or two bulldozer chairmen and the usual assault to beach vehicles. The only activity that was going on was there was a Junkers 88 flying about upstairs, and the sky was littered with red tracer shells and things. That was the only thing. But you were so busy occupied and getting off the beach inland that you didn't have much time to see what was going on the beach.
Now you moved.
It was Courcelles where they landed, I think. And I remember there was a big hotel up there with one or two holes in it. There was nothing exciting about it. We just drove on to through some sand dunes and onto a road and landed up at a place called Cully, I think.
That's right. Now, you were at Cully for about 10 days. I just wanted to look at some of the things, that sort of what life was like while you were there, because I don't believe much happened while you were at Cully.
Well, while we were at Cully, and Alistair McCarthy was the commander there.
Let's go through the crew first, because that would be a good thing. Now, your crew sergeant, was Lance Sergeant Alistair McCarthy.
That's right.
And what was he like as a crew commander? Can you give us a sort of pen portrait of him?
We were all very, very fond of Alistair. I mean, he was a brough, deep-voiced policeman. He was a policeman in Hamilton. And we got on great. We really did with him. There was him and there was Pat Kettridge, which was the wireless operator. Jack Edwards was the gunner.
What was the wireless? What was this Pat Kettridge like? What was he like?
Very nice, tall, nice mannered, well-spoken Englishman that I liked very much. We actually palled about in Aldershot before we left. And we did things like his girlfriend was coming down to see him. And he got put on a special guard, and he couldn't get off it. I offered to do it for him, but it had to be a wireless operator on this particular wireless watch or something he was on. So he asked me to go and meet his girlfriend. And she was very nice, and I had to entertain her. And actually, I managed to give him half an hour with her when he came off guard. I kept her back to the last train up to London. He was a Londoner, you see. Anyway, that's just a little story about Platt.
And the other one, Gunner Jack Edwards. Now, we're perhaps going to see him. He's still alive. What was he like?
Very quiet, dependable chap. An incident to describe him was I was making tea. I was actually in the co-driver's seat, and I had this petrol stove, which was dead against orders. The petrol stove suddenly overheated and blew up, and went into flames. And this voice from the turret said, "Okay, that's okay." And through the turret came the fire extinguisher, a foam fire extinguisher, and just blew it out. That's the sort of thing that Jack was doing.
And the other one, your co-driver, was Taffy Pemba.
Ah, yes.
So you were in a 75mm Sherman at the time. Yes. And what was Taffy? Well,
Taffy was like a very good sense of humour. Taffy, he was a good joker. We got on well as well.
He was Welsh, I presume.
He was Welsh, yes. Well, that was a good combination. Two Scotsmen, a Manchester. Jack came from Manchester and Taffy came from one good someplace or another. So we were quite a good crew.
Would he help with the driving? I know he had his own job in the town, but I mean, would you take it in turns?
Funnily enough, co-drivers never seemed to bother. They were happy in their little corner on their own. They were happy.
Now, you did. It often seems that the co-drivers did the cooking, but in your tank, it sounds like you did the cooking.
Most of the time, I seem to be good at making tea. I don't know.
Now, I want to look at what food you got, particularly while at Cully. But anyway, I mean, what about? I believe a lot of the time you got compo rations.
Yes.
What could you explain what compo was and then how you'd cook it?
Compo was just powdered milk and almost powdered tea, small tea leaves, and sugar mixed together. and you just boil the water and put it in, and you got a sort of not a very nice cup of tea, really, but that was what compo was.
What about the rations? What food did you get?
It was mostly biscuits and corned beef and odd tins of things that you got. Well, when we went over first, we got a D-Day pack, which an emergency pack. It was a little plastic container with a block or two blocks of porridge, which was concentrated, and you could make porridge, but it wasn't exciting, but it was edible. And you got a bar of chocolate and some cigarettes, and they were all in this plastic container, and a mat, a little silk mat, in case you got in case you got lost. And that was the only thing we had with us when we landed. But rations, our quartermaster was quite good. He came up with rations pretty quickly. I can't tell you whether we got cooked meals or not, proper meals or not, because we had so much groceries on our tank that we could have survived on.
No, you haven't actually explained that. Can you tell us the story of that? That was off tape. But what about the groceries? How did all that come about?
That was Alistair's uncle. He had an uncle in Cheam who was the manager of a wholesale grocer's establishment. And he insisted that we come up as often as we could get away, and he would give us odd things to help us survive.
Food,
yeah. Tins of food and big packages of oatmeal and stuff like that. We were fond of our porridge, although Taffy Pember and Jack Edwards weren't too keen on our porridge because we put salt in ours and he wanted sugar. So, I mean, we had things like tin steak and meat roll and all these sort of grocery things that you could have in tins.
And yeah. You had a lot of this?
We had a lot of beans on toast. And we had quite a few loaves of bread and lots of biscuits.
And where would you carry all this?
Well, stacked into every corner that we could in the tank, just behind bins and things.
Now, while you were in this field, what sort of, how did you set up? I mean, were you parked alongside the hedge, or where were you? Because a cully, I mean, before you went into action.
Yeah, we were in a sort of a field below a raised bit, and on this raised bit, I think was the Ayrshire Yeomanry, with 25 pounders. They were all lined up behind us. And we had bivouacs. The bivouac that was provided with all the tanks was something that you could, like a tent at the side, fixed on the side of the tank, was quite comfortable. But they were good things. They had a bark sheet and a ground sheet, and all the bedding was rolled up in this, one blanket and things. Anyway,
and where would this be stored normally?
Just tied on the back of your tank, that was all.
In the open?
In the open, outside, yeah.
And so that was a sort of triangle affair that came off?
That's right, yeah.
And
I think the word bivouac sort of means that.
I think it does, yeah. What extra equipment would you carry on the tank or in the tank?
Well, you had a big axe, shovel and crowbar, tow rope. I can't think of much else.
Had you got any extra weapons then? Because I know crews used to acquire Stens and Tommies and things like that. But
no, you were issued with a Bren. I can't remember where it was stored, but I think you were issued with a Bren then. I may be wrong, I can't just think where it was, but we had a Bren. Because I remember having to use it once later on.
Well, Well, that's probably something we'll come to then. What about just other things, just picking up on things? What about cigarette or rum ration? Did you get them?
I think we were all well off issued with cigarettes. I think we were issued with quite a lot of cigarettes before we left. I'm not sure. But most of us had got parcels from home. You could put your name in for parcels from some charitable establishments. They sent forces parcels out with, and you could claim duty-free cigarettes. I think most of us were well stocked up with cigarettes before we went over.
And what would be in the parcels?
In the parcels?
Besides cigarettes, huh?
Well, sometimes an odd bar of chocolate and a cake or two. The usual sort of things that a soldier would like extra above his rations. I was lucky. I had a church. I wasn't really a member of the church, but my folk were, and they had the good. They sent good parcels out. That's mainly. That covers the acquisition of extra food.
Now, while you were in this period, there was supposed to be some knocked out tanks nearby. Did you go and see them? Some people did, some people didn't.
On landing.
Well, while you were at Cully. Because we were there about 10 days.
We didn't see anything much until we moved, till we went into action, and then you passed the battle areas.
Let's go on to that then, because that is Operation Epsom, as they call it, which was on the 26th of June, and then for the next 4 or 5 days.
Just one little thing before, before you leave Cully. The first night we were there, the artillery got what I think they called it a mic target, meant that they had to fire a complete barrage for half an hour or something to soften a particular area that the infantry were going to advance over the next day. And this was to get the Germans' head down and try and clear up a passage, you know. So this mic target went on the first night we were there, and we were all just about deafened and lying there. Funnily enough, you went to sleep. Sometimes you can sleep in a noise, and when the noise stops, you wake up. And this is what happened to us on the first night. When the barrage was over, nobody could get to sleep after that, even when it was quiet, you know. So that's just a little incident that happened in Cully, I can remember. The 10 nights that were there, there wasn't a barrage every night, but when there was, you didn't seem to notice it so much, you just fell asleep, woke up when it stopped.
Now, the Operation Epsom was the 26th of June, and that was when you went forward, and B Squadron and the Recce troop were leading behind some infantry.
Yeah.
Basically to cross the Odon, and you were advancing on Shire, I think.
That's right.
Now, what sort of briefing would you get first? I mean, if there was any.
Well, you just got orders on how to proceed, how close you were, and whether you were to be one up or in line or something like that. That was mainly what was happening.
And would you get told that, or just the truth? Would just the your?
It would come across the ASAP. We heard all the orders, individual orders. I think orders from outside the regiment, like brigade orders and that, would be on a different net. We wouldn't hear that. That would go to the colonel and he would get his orders separate. We never got anything like that. We just got regimental wireless procedure through the ASAP. Advancing at the start was kind of uneventful until we got to this blooming orchard, I think. And then there's...
Now, where was the orchard? Was that actually in Shire?
Yeah. And we had...
What could you see? What was the sort of scene? I mean, were you up or down?
I couldn't see much. I didn't even see the shell exploding, the one that hit the tree.
So, let's get this. You had your hatch down. You were down.
Yeah.
So, you using the...
All I would see would be the visual angle of the angle of sight through the periscope, you wouldn't get in the same one. But you kept, you know, just twisting it and looking around all the time. If when you're actually driving along, you're it's not like a car where your hands on the wheel. You could sit like this with your arms folded and go along quite well because you weren't steering until you pulled the lever, and that was. So you had two hands to work the periscope, swivel it about.
Now, had you seen anything happening before the shell, you know, you were hit? Because we'll come to that. So, but had you, what had you seen before then? Any signs of anything happening?
Not really, not really. No, it just kept trundling along and more or less advancing. And I can't really remember how much involvement the driver had, with. You couldn't see much. You couldn't see. I never saw any Germans or Panthers or anything like that. There was a few Panthers, and there were some knocked out in that battle. I never saw much.
And did you see any British tanks going up?
Oh no! When you're in a tank, you tend to be. If there was nobody in front of you, if you were in line or something, you were all one there and one there. You didn't see anything.
So, what was it actually like in a tank going into action? What was the sort of atmosphere in a tank like?
Noisy, but not bad because you had a fairly good headset on. And when there was firing going on and the guns were firing, there was a smell of cordite, quite strong.
Did the engine smell?
No. The Sherman had a big fan to cool off the five engines. It was five banked engines. It was there. They had the main cooling system, and it sucked air through the turret and through the driver's seat. That was the only time you were bothered was in winter when it was cold air. You were getting in. Again, you didn't notice. They were very air-conditioned, so you see.
Did you get pashed about in the normal, just driving about the tank? I mean, did it joggle you about a lot, or was it fairly smooth?
Not a lot, because it was a fairly heavy vehicle, and it smoothed its own way out on ground. Until you met deep holes and things, then you got. But, it's amazing how much a Sherman could tilt and not fall over,
And now, so you got to this orchard, Sher Orchard, an orchard in Sher, and then this is where you were hit. What exactly happened, as far as you were concerned?
Well, the tank actually wasn't hit. It was Alistair was wounded with shrapnel from the shell. If you saw his helmet after he was wounded, you wouldn't believe that anybody had survived from it, but he had a pretty bad head wound. He had to have a metal plate in it later on when he got home. So he was pretty bad, but Alistair had sort of little fads that he had I think it was a German commando jacket, which was gaudily camouflaged, and he had this on. It was a very comfortable jacket, and he liked it, and he had this on, and he went to the advanced dressing station, and he was sat in this tent, and they thought he was a German. And he sat there, and other people were coming in wounded and getting attended to, and Alistair thought, he said, "Oh, what's going on here?" So he started to speak, and the orderlies thought, "Well, he's not a German." Then he got treated, but he had this fad. He also he collected weapons. He had a lot of weapons. I'm not sure where he got them, but I know when I visited him years later in Hamilton, he had a cupboard full of wet Lugers and B-38s and things. It was amazing. I had to give them all up when the police called them in.
Now, what were the effects? So, you know, when this shell went off and wounded him, did that have any effect on the tank as a whole?
Not very much, no. There was probably like being hit with a machine gun or something. No, not much.
Now, what happened when he was wounded? What did you all do?
You know, I can't just do it. Pat took over.
This is Pat Kettridge.
He took over as commander, and Andy was a wee bit. Andy was quite good on the wireless. We just carried on.
You carried on going forward.
Yeah.
So how did you get Makati evacuated? Or did someone come and collect him? Or
he got out of the tank, because we couldn't get out because there was stuff flying about. He just probably lay down, and I'm not sure what happened. But Pat, I remember Pat saying he's away. Somebody collected him, whether it was a stretcher party or some of the infantry, but somebody helped him back into the forward dressing station.
So Kettridge took over as tank commander.
Yeah.
And what happened next? Anything else you remember about that action?
You know, it's very hazy, but half the time you weren't quite sure what was going on until you got back to harbour, and then you exchanged the information with other people and you got to know who had been chopped off and who had got wounded and so on.
As a driver, it sounds like you didn't really have any sort of picture of the battle at all,
really. No, you couldn't really. You were closed in there in a metal container, so you didn't really. I mean, a driver of a tank really is an essential person, but he's not. He doesn't tend to be. Be able to see things that goes on. He gets information through the wireless, but it's not the gunner has more to do than the driver. You might sit for quite a while when the gun's blazing and everything round about you. You can't do anything. You just observe, and if possible, if you see something. But at one occasion, when I remember, I saw some Germans down in a hall, clearing up and ready departing with a Minenwerfer, you know, one of these modern minis. And I thought that's a very good target there, and I couldn't get on. They were on ASAP, so I couldn't get on to the commander to advise them that there was a. And I think I was the only one in the tank that saw them. So that was an occasion missed. And we could have got some Germans.
Do you know if your tank claimed any hits or anything?
No, I don't think. I can't. You see, when we got back, all the crews were all changed again.
Well, there's two sides to that. One is, what happened when he got... Could you explain what a lager was? Because let's have a look at that, and then we'll have a look at the crew changes.
You just got back, and you formed a square, more or less. The lager, the word comes from the Boer War, really, from the Dutch. I think it's an Afrikaans word, really, the lager. You just formed a square, and your infantry... who were attached to, they dug in all round about as a sort of protection.